The next matter on for oral argument this morning is HER, the Commissioner of Public Safety. Counsel, as you're squaring yourself away, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 minutes for respondent or for appellant if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. The podium has a button in the front that allows you to raise or lower it to match your height to your convenience. I don't always say that, but I think there's a significant disparity of height today between our council. Thought I'd offer that up for you. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, and do be mindful of our timing restrictions indicated in the light and clock in the podium. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are fully situated and ready to go, you may approach and present your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Levitt, L-E-A-V-I-T-T, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Yia HER. Two issues on appeal today. The first issue is, did the trial court err in ruling that the petitioner hesitating for approximately 5 seconds when a traffic light turned green consisted of reasonable articulable suspicion for an investigatory stop? And the second issue is, did the trial court err in ruling that the officers testified credibly that petitioner's an appellant at this time's driving conduct consisted of crossing the center line, touching the fog line, or drifting within his lane in violation of Minnesota Statutes 169.18. To begin, I would be remiss not to point out there was a citation error in my procedural history, improperly cited. This was filed for judicial review under 169A.53, properly subdivision 2. It says 169A.51. Also, in the legal issues, it says 169 subdivision 2, but that is correctly cited in the table of authorities and was properly filed under 169A.53 subdivision 2.
Thank you.
I have a question about your client's pause and going forward. Throughout your briefing, you say that it was 5 seconds. The district court finding was that it was 5 to 10 seconds. Does that change your analysis if we go with 10 seconds as opposed to 5 seconds?
I don't believe it changes my analysis, as I think it still would fall under Helmstad. I think that the 5 to 10 second approximation also is not taken into consideration to the fact that the officer testified that it could have been less than 5 seconds. So. And also wrote that it was approximately 5 seconds in her report. So I think when you take all those things together, the approximate 5 seconds is the mark that we should be looking at. But the district court did find 5 to 10 seconds, as that was testified to by both Officer Burt McGregor and Officer HER.
What do we do with their testimony and the court's finding that your client's pausing at the light, not going forward, impeded her ability to move forward when the light turned green, which is what the statute talks about?
Yes, thank you. Under 169.15, it's no person shall drive a motor vehicle at such a slow speed as to impede or block the normal and reasonable movement of traffic, except when reduced speed is necessary for safe operation or in compliance with law, et cetera. I think that that's not on point here. No person shall drive, just by the plain language of the statute. He's not driving. He hasn't begun to drive yet. He's stopped. And I think also by relying on 169.15, it...
He's driving, just not moving.
Correct.
And even
if applied, if we take out whether he's stopped driving, I think that Helmstad considers this and states that 4 seconds, absent other conduct, is not enough for a stop.
So when I read Helmstad, the the bulk, I was going to say the majority, but the bulk of that opinion dealt with this tip that started everything in process. And the court focused on the tip and then in a couple of paragraphs at the end talked about the impeding.
Yes, and I think that what that shows is that there was more conduct to be looked at in Helmstad, that there was a tip of intoxication. They had a reason to suspect this driver already, and some of the other cases cited by the state shows that tips can be enough just for a stop in themselves. So there's already a tip, which may or may not be enough for a stop. And then on top of that, there is the driving conduct of delaying at a stoplight. Now, I think that that makes Helmstad's case a lot stronger for a stop than the case here, in which the stoplight is the first occurrence of this officer and the citizen encountering each other.
How do you respond to the respondent citing to the Liberda case? I realize it's unpublished.
Yes, so Liberda is a 20-second delay at a green light. So the light turns green and they delay for 20 seconds. And it's unpublished, but the court specifically references the Helmstad decision and says that 4 seconds, absent other conduct, is not enough for a stop. 20 seconds is absolutely enough for a stop. And the court in that case stated, we don't know where the line is between 4 and 20, but 20 is definitely enough for a stop. But it would also seem to affirm, though unpublished, that 4 seconds and something close to it in Helmstad would not be enough for a stop on its own.
Would you agree that the crossing the center line is perhaps the stronger reason for stopping the vehicle?
I think if it's ruled that it occurred, it is the stronger, yes.
Officer Burns McGregor testified that she saw it, right?
Yes, she did.
And the district court credited her testimony?
Yes, they did. And so I know that there is a heavy burden. It is extremely hard to overturn. So the standard here would be clearly erroneous. Whether the finding of fact that Officer Burt McGregor testified credibly that he crossed the center line would only be overturned if there was a mistake by the district court. Now, I think when you look at a situation like this, and this may be necessary to narrow to cases where there is no dash cam video, because the vast, vast majority of law enforcement vehicles in this state have dash cam. And I think that much more often than not, that's going to benefit police officers to document what happened.
My understanding is that dash cams, and I could be wrong, don't go on until the lights start flashing.
And I believe there is a backup, a 30-second backup, when they turn on their siren. And, you know, officers will typically have their dash cam on when they are following a potential drunk driver to document that driving conduct.
I don't understand how the dash cam argument bears on this case where there was no dash cam.
Absolutely. So in this case where there is no dash cam, it's extremely important to take reports. The reports are not evidence, but they're documenting the evidence in the case.
You seem to be making an argument that one typically makes to a fact finder. And in order for us to decide in your favor, we would have to say that the district court clearly erred in its weighing of credibility. The district court didn't just rely upon documentary evidence. The district court had the officer's live testimony, if I understand correctly, and could assess the demeanor of the witnesses. And whether that's a reliable basis for assessing credibility, appellate courts have said forever that that's something that is available to the district court and not available on appeal.
So a couple points as to that. I don't believe that it is simply reweighing facts or credibility in that manner. And the reason is that a lot of those cases, such as DeMar's, they have situations where multiple people are testifying to different things, different experts, and the fact finder is absolutely in the best position to judge that credibility, and the appellate court is not in a position to reweigh the credibility of different witnesses. Similarly, in Berg, it was held that a police officer could make inferences, and so credibility was at issue. I think that the differentiation here is that the credibility of the officers is inherently in conflict with their own documentary evidence. So it's not just whether they testified credibly on the stand, but...
When you say in conflict with, you mean not expressly supported by, don't you? There's no documentary evidence saying that Mr. Herr did not cross the center line, did not weave in the lane. Just that there's a lack of that in the documentary evidence. At least that's what I thought was the basis of your challenge on appeal.
I could agree that it's not necessarily supported by, but I think that it's important when the appellate court has the exact same record that the district court had in this matter. All contemporaneous documentation does not mention anything about any driving conduct.
Well, it does at 147. So when I did the timeline, tell me if I'm wrong in following the argument. So at 10:15, the citation is filled out and just mentions the pause. At 12:04, the peace officer's certificate is filled out at the station, doesn't mention the, I'll call it the driving conduct. And then finally at 1:47 a.m., the primary narrative does mention it. Is that the timeline you're relying on?
That is the timeline, yes.
Okay.
And so there is the one statement, one sentence during which I observed the driver cross the center line.
Right.
In the primary narrative, which goes on for numerous other paragraphs, Officer Herr also filled out a small narrative report here, mentions nothing about driving conduct, nothing about the light. And the reason why I think that appellate review is so necessary here is because we have one sentence hours after the fact that he crossed the center line.
Getting back to Judge Ross's point, here from the order, you did cross-examine the officers about the lack of earlier mention of the driving conduct.
Yes.
At the hearing. The judge found both officers testified credibly. However, that petitioner was in violation of Min Stat 169.18. And so, unlike us, the district court had the first row seat to listen to the testimony along with the written reports and made this credibility finding.
Yes, understood, Your Honor.
And you may disagree.
I understand that is a heavy burden for the appellate to meet. I think that when you look at all of these cases that mention the clearly erroneous standard, you're going to see that it's, you know, you can see Rule 5201, Rule Civil Procedure referenced, and you're going to see that findings will not be overturned, but there is constantly that reference to it unless there is clear error. So I understand that it's a heavy burden for the appellant to meet in this matter, but I would look at State v. Quam, where in the holding they say a trial court's finding is erroneous if this court, after reviewing the record, reaches the firm conviction that a mistake was made. And so I do believe that review is still available.
Well, and I'm going to ask respondent's attorney this because, for instance, I don't think there's record support that your client touched the fog line.
Correct.
So that would be, if there's no record support...
And that it goes along with the argument that clear error is here because the officer's testimony were in conflict with each other. Officer Herr had the exact same vantage point as Officer Burt McGregor, and he testified that he patrols for years alone in a car, and he can see both sides of the cars that
he was driving.
Officer Burt McGregor was driving.
So it was a matter of physics. The officer in the passenger seat is not going to be able to have the same perspective regardless of what the officer testified to. I mean, there's just physics. So the officer
understood.
Can't see through a car,
and
so
that's
can't
why,
see the front wheel.
And that's why I cross-examined Officer Herr to ask him, when patrolling alone, can you see both sides of the car? That's why they follow at a distance where they can see both sides of the car. Even if they're the only person in the driver's seat, they can still see the car cross the fog line. He did not see the car cross the center line.
Missing my physics argument, regardless of what he testified to, you'd have to agree with me, wouldn't you, that an officer or any person in a passenger seat simply does not have the same, an equal perspective about the driver's side of the vehicle as the driver does.
I agree with you. They do not have the same perspective. But
so it is possible, physically possible, for there to be a circumstance where the driver of a car sees the car in front of it touching the center line and the passenger being physically unable to see that same circumstance because of the location and the vantage point. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. It is possible. But
regardless of the testimony.
I agree with that. But I also believe that it's possible for a passenger to be able to see the rear of the vehicle, see the left side, see the tire, see whether it crosses the center line, see where the center line is. But yes, it is possible that they have a different vantage point and the driver could see something different. But also, there's no documentation anywhere that there was drifting. I think that it is very easy, and it is in their interest to put into their reports exactly what they saw. Driving conduct should be first and foremost, and if it occurred, you put that into the contemporaneous reports. There's nothing about weaving. There's nothing about drifting.
Well, there are a lot of things that should go into a report that may not go into the report, which doesn't mean that the thing unreported didn't occur.
That's correct, but I think
district court seemed to recognize that. And were you trial counsel?
Yes.
I mean, I saw the transcript that the cross-examination was thorough on this point, and you touched on it and pressed the officer and you put the issue of credibility front and center in the district court, framed it up for the district court to make a decision, and the decision was made.
And if I may have a couple moments for a final thought.
You can finish and wrap up in a sentence. You will also have time for rebuttal.
I think that that's where the lack of dash cam comes in when the officers, the clear error can also be found when the district court finds that he touched the center line and Officer Hurt explicitly testified that he was drifting in his lane toward the center line, but did not, or the fog line, excuse me, the fog line, but did not touch across the fog line. And that 3.5 months after the fact, with no reports to any of this conduct, no video to refresh the recollection, that should be taken into account whether clear error was here as to what their memories are, especially when they're in conflict with each other and the driving conduct was not written down.
Thank you, Mr. Leavitt. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time if you'd like to use that. Counsel for the state. And the button should be right in front.
Yeah, sorry.
You find it? Yeah, there you go. Now we see you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Leah Hedman. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here today on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety. The conduct in this case is clear. The stop was upheld because the appellant's vehicle waited at a red light after it turned green, paused for 5 to 10 seconds with no movement, with a squad car fully marked directly behind it. It waited that 5 to 10 seconds and then proceeded forward. Immediately, the lights did not go off. It was no stop occurred at that point. Instead, the vehicle with the officer's squad proceeded behind it to watch for additional conduct, and they saw it. Officer Burt McGregor in the driver's seat, as mentioned earlier, observed that he crossed the center line in front of her, his white truck. And then Officer Fang Hare, her field training officer with 10 years of experience, observed that the vehicle drifted within the lane over to the fog line, but did not touch or cross the fog line.
Do you agree the district court clearly erred in the fog line finding?
No, I think any such inconsistency with the exact transcript, it was challenging. I myself even felt for that as well because of the way the words came in. I pulled the citations from the record, and looking at page 49 of the transcript, which, of course, you can see later, it just said, What, if anything, do you recall regarding the white truck and the driver's side tire in terms of the center line?
And who's testifying here?
Thank you, Officer Feng Hare. And he says candidly, I did not see the driver's side crossing the center line, but I saw the vehicle weaving or drifting within the within lanes. It didn't cross over the white line on the passenger side, but it was drifting. And then question, okay, and that's the fog line, meaning that white line on the passenger side. Is that right? That is the fog line, yes. Later down, it says, it says the center line would probably be easier for her to see, meaning Officer Burt McGregor, and Officer Feng Hare says yes, and the fog line would probably be easier for you to see, and Officer Feng Hare says yes. Okay, but you recall the vehicle weaving? Correct. He never wavers with regard to that. If you move then to page 60 of the transcript, he talks about the discrepancy with, you know, things not being documented perfectly because he's the field training officer, and he says, I went over the reports, you know, for that. And then let's talk just briefly about the issue raised with regard to his report. He did a supplemental
report.
Hold on,
just so we're not lost on the question. My question was asked to the fog line. Is there evidence to support the district court's finding that Mr. Herr drove over the fog line or onto the fog line?
Yeah, I don't believe so. I think that this...
That was my question. So that was a clear error. There's no evidence to support that finding.
I think so. But any error, I think, here would be harmless because the weaving in and of itself over to the fog line, which is what I think that it says here, they're indicating is enough under the Cruz versus Commissioner of Public Safety case. That specifically would be 906 Northwest 2nd 554, a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 2018. It was onto the center line and onto the fog line, but not over it, wasn't required. And that, because he drove on the fog line, at reasonable grounds to suspect a violation of Minnesota Statute 169.18. But again, we're looking at the totality of the circumstances, and we're looking at it from an objective standard.
That's what I want to get a sense of. I'm trying to understand the basis for your argument. Are you saying that because Mr. Herr violated the impediment to other drivers statute, that that's the basis for the stop, that that would justify the stop, or that the driving conduct, including the delay in leaving the traffic control device at the intersection, would support the inference that the driver may be impaired? What is exactly the gist of your argument?
Yeah, thank you. It's a two-pronged reason for the stop, and Officer Burt McGregor testifies to that. She says, over the center line, and then she says, because he waited at that light for 5 to 10 seconds, and she says more than 5 seconds in her citation narration. With regard to the credit given to the officers, it's that both officers testified credibly. So if you look at this in terms of the totality of the circumstances, as I believe the trial court did, it's both things.
I'm not sure I quite understand the answer to the question, though.
Okay.
Is it your argument that there was a traffic violation that supports the stop, or that the driving conduct overall would lead an officer to suspect that the driver may be impaired?
My answer is both. Let me tell you why. First of all, crossing the center line alone is enough for a stop, and we have clear evidence by her documenting in a report at the time. It's in the narrative, and she testifies, and she is given credit by this court. So that in and of itself is enough and has been held up to be enough for the very minimal standard required to effectuate a traffic stop. But here you have the center line, and you have that he's drifting within the lanes, and the officer here mentions the fog line. Why is that important? Because it's from lane to lane. It's from center line to fog line, and that is the classic drift talked about in Cruz. He crosses the center line here, and that's the similar to Cruz where the driver crosses the fog line. It's the crossing of the lanes that confirms that this is a violation of Minnesota Statute 169.18. With regard to the impediment question, I think, posed by appellant, he raises, is it enough to say 5 seconds? I appreciate the court's candor in saying, really, the court's crediting 5 to 10 seconds of a wait. Whether you use the old standby, one Mississippi, or the 1-1000, If you count out 10 1/1000s or one Mississippi's, that is a very long time.
Right, but the district court didn't find that Mr. Herr was at the intersection for 10 seconds, but that was 5 to 10 seconds. So
agreed.
We don't know. So don't we have to, at least for the sake of motion to suppress, assume that the district court recognized the stop, the delay was as short as 5 seconds?
I appreciate the ability to clarify. This is an implied consent hearing under civil rules, so the motion to suppress would be applicable only in the criminal case, not for this one. So again, our burden is quite different because I would be under a preponderance or 51% as opposed to...
But you still have to have reasonable suspicion for the stop. That's my point.
Right. And that's here. I mean, this is a good stop. A failure to maintain the lane and to cross the center line, think of it, that's going into the opposing lane of traffic. It's Friday night, it's 10:18.
Help us to understand what you would say is the length of time after which the officer has reasonable suspicion, or actually probable cause, to stop for a violation of the impediment statute. So a car is stopped at a red light, light turns green. How long, if there's a car immediately behind that car that can't proceed on the green light, how long is enough to violate that statute?
I'd like to answer the question in 2 points. The first thing, not the facts here. We don't just have him waiting for a certain period of time. We have the center line, we have the fog line.
I had suggested that that would be enough by itself. So I'm asking you, if that's all we have.
Well, we have impeding. We have testimony. So we have a clear amount of time here, 5 to 10 seconds. I think it is enough because the officer says, my squad was impeded.
Is 5 seconds enough?
I think that's a question the court need not answer, but I think that...
Why not? If the district court said, it was between 5 and 10, meaning it might have been just 5. Why isn't that a question the court...
Because you have the center line crossing and you have the fog line. It's just simply not the facts here.
I'm trying to narrow the question on the issue, on the question of law. I'm trying to get a sense of what the state's position is as to how long is too long as a violation of the statute, not as a concern about impairment, but how long is enough to violate the statute?
I think that the key to it is maybe not the determination of exactly a seconds, 4 seconds, 6 seconds, 8 seconds. I don't think that's a determination. I think it's the totality. And here you have him stopped at a red light with a marked squad directly behind him.
Why does it matter whether there's a marked car? The statute doesn't have any bearing. It doesn't include the type of car being impeded as a factor.
Thank you, but the fact of the matter is for stops and for the reasonable articulable suspicion, the totality of the circumstances is looked at, and that is what was considered by the district court properly here.
Maybe I'm being too precise with my question or not precise enough. I'm trying to get a sense of when is, how long, Your argument is that if you stop at a red light long enough without proceeding, after the light turns green, that is, and not proceeding, that is a violation of the statute.
Right.
And you would agree with me that I assume that if you wait 1 second and drive forward, that would not violate the statute. I think you would agree with me that if you sit there for 3 minutes, that would violate the statute. I'm trying to get a sense of what the state's position is as to when a violation occurs. It doesn't matter what kind of car is behind you.
I agree. I'm just saying for the totality of the circumstances, it is part of the analysis, I think, normally done. But if you're looking specifically for an answer with regard to that, there's no time within the language of the statute given. It is just that there is impeding. And the language read, I would note, because there was a question about whether being stopped it meets the term definition of impeding. No person shall drive a motor vehicle at such a slow speed as to impede or block the normal and reasonable movement of traffic except when reduced speed is necessary. The subdivision 2 is intersection gridlock, stop or block traffic. And that is...
That's what I'm not understanding your argument. I just want you to tell us when...
Yeah,
when does a person block traffic?
I beg your pardon. So I think he's clearly impeding the squad from moving forward. In terms of 4 seconds, if you look at Helmstead as an impediment case, which I think the court is right, it is really not. It is whether or not that an anonymous tip was bolstered, which claimed that there was an intoxicated driver. But if you consider that, then 4 seconds is not enough time. When you look at Wilkes has longer period of time, and that has... The vehicle was 50 to 100 feet past the intersection in the middle of the light, and the officer said he was impeded and had to alter his speed. Not a time limit necessarily, but that he was impeded. That appears to be moments, not necessarily, seconds, not necessarily giving a number in Wilkes. So Liberia, 20 seconds clearly meets the mark. So within that, I'm trying to do my best to answer your question.
I think you're saying, if I understand you correctly, that 4 seconds isn't long enough, but 30 seconds is.
4 seconds may not be enough, but I think it again, you don't just read a statute in the cold.
If four seconds is not long enough, is 5 seconds long enough?
I think under these facts, yes. Why do I say that? Because he sat there for a whole period of the red light, and then it turned green. And you expect the normal flow of traffic to proceed through the intersection. There's no one else at the intersection, period. It's him and the squad. And if you sit there and you count out 1 1,000, 2 1,000, 3 1,000, 4 1,000, 5, that would alert this officer, which it did, as well as Officer Fang, her training officer, that this was too long. Both of them testified, it seemed unreasonably long to me. I am being impeded. And that was clearly in pages 22 and 23 of the transcript. Because I think the totality of the circumstances here indicates that without question, there was reasonable articulable suspicion for the stop of this vehicle based on the totality, the night. It's a Friday night. It's 10:18 p.m. It's also that there was a reasonable articulable suspicion for the stop based upon that wait, unreasonable wait, without any cause to do it. There's no deer running out. There's nothing impeding him. There's not even another car that he could wait for or be concerned about. Nothing in the intersection at all. It's just unreasonable not to have alerted the officers. But they don't stop him merely for that. And the testimony is they waited. They saw the lane use, that crossing the center line and drifting all the way over to the fog line, but not onto or over the fog line. But that conduct indicates, and crossing the center line alone is enough for you to uphold the stop. It's especially important here because of the credibility determination made by the district court. And I appreciate the candor of this appellate and reviewing court in knowing that the district court is in a better position to judge the character of a person on the stand. They're able to hear inflection. They're able to see the candor or perhaps lack of candor. They're able to determine whether or not the believability of that person, which doesn't come off the same in a flat transcript. Again, the clearly erroneous standard under State v. DD 795 Northwest 2nd 836 at 846-47. It's a Minnesota case from 2011. That is, the finding and facts are clearly erroneous if on the entire evidence, the court is left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake occurred. I don't feel that this court would be warranted in such a firm conviction here. You have clear, credited testimony by two officers. I think in some respects it's more credible that it doesn't match exactly perfect. There wasn't anything like that. May I make one final point just in seconds?
I'm glad your opponent, so go ahead and you can wrap up with the sentence.
Thank you. I just want to, in case there was something I didn't cover, with regard to the question of Officer Fang Hare's supporting narrative, it is within the documents admitted. It is part of the police report. It is merely lines, and it explains that he translated for the defendant during the field sobriety tests. That's the only thing he added, was that he documented that he translated in Hmong so it would be easier for him to understand the kind of specific questions required for field sobriety. That's all he did. He wasn't documenting the basis for the response for the stop here.
I have a question. You mentioned the Cruz case a couple times. Do you have a spelling and a citation for that?
Absolutely. Cruz is K-R-U-S-E. It's at 906 Northwest 2nd 554. It is from this honorable court from 2018.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Thomas Levitt on behalf of Yeher. The question I want to pose to the court is, how practically does a district court find an officer not credible in this circumstance? The Fourth Amendment protects citizens against unreasonable searches and seizures where there's no dash cam, where all contemporaneous notes, citation, peace officer certificate, body camera, there's no conversation between the two officers that he was weaving, that he crossed the center line, that he touched the fog line. She's later asked by another officer, was he swerving or something, in Exhibit 3, and she replies, he waited at that green light back there. When there is all of this contemporaneous information showing that there is one reason for a stop, that it's documented, there is one reason for a stop, and that is what should be considered, green light, how long, how practically is a citizen supposed to document that they did not cross the center line, that they did not weave in their lane, when there is no dash cam and months, 5 months approximately, 4.5 months after the incident, no reports, refreshing recollection about what driving conduct occurred other than cross the center line. There's nothing about weaving, nothing about drifting. Officer Herr has nothing about anything. If I stop people every day in my occupation, 5 months ago, I'm going to remember the exact circumstances of one stop. So I'm asking, how practically does a district court find them not credible? Is it just simply they testify, I saw them cross the center line? If it's found credible, then there's no ability to appeal. The clear error standard says that the district court found it credible, and so effectively limiting citizens' ability to appeal that type of factual determination, where in this case...
Well, it doesn't limit the ability to appeal, but it restrains our view. It tells us how we look at the case. Your client can still appeal, but your client has to point to something, and I haven't heard it yet, which is, what is the smoking gun, the bombshell, that makes it evident to us that a clear mistake was made, that the court just missed it on the fact-finding? What is the most significant piece of evidence or circumstance that you can point to that would convince me that the district court made a mistake in crediting the officer's testimony?
I don't believe there's a specific smoking gun. As I stated earlier, I understand that this is a high burden, and that's what I was getting at, that the citizen himself is not in any position to document what happened. So I would say under the totality of the circumstances, which is the standard here, you have documentation, citation, body cam, peace officer certificate. All of these are stating one thing. That can provide the basis for clear error, that to simply find them credible based on testimony, you know, the officer could conceivably testify that they saw him hit someone that night. If the district court finds that credible, and no one was hit, if the district court finds that credible, the appellant is going to have no ability to prove that he did not hit someone. And so
the argument seems to be challenging the very essence of testimonial evidence, which we've always said and the Supreme Court's always said, if even one person's word against the word of a dozen others is substantial evidence, sufficient evidence to support a finding, because the district court might believe that person's word. How is your argument really any different from a challenge to the idea that testimony is evidence?
Because the person's own documentation closer to the time, outside of testimony, before testimony, is implicitly in conflict. Now, it is not saying in conflict he did not cross the center line, but everything in that is pointing to the fact that it did not happen. Their own testimony, if you will, when they are affirming, you know, in the peace officer certificate to the Department of Public Safety, they have a certification at the beginning about how they are a peace officer and what they are affirming to the Department of Public Safety. Now, in that's similar to testimonial evidence. They are submitting what happened, and they're submitting that he did not go at a green light. And so I would say it is in conflict with their own testimony, their own stated recollection of
the event. I just want to make sure I understand. I mean, the officer Burns McGregor did a full police report later that night, a couple hours later, correct? And in that full report, she mentioned crossing the center line, correct?
She mentions it one time in one sentence.
It's not in this, I guess, the citation, or not in another document. I forget how it's described, but it's more of a summary document with limited space. But when she was typing the police report without any limited space, she did say that he went over the center line within hours of the event.
Yes. Citation has a paragraph, so it has space. There is space within the line in the peace officer certificate. The report does have more space, which she put, it looks like, eight paragraphs down. And in those paragraphs, there is one sentence that he crossed the center line. There's nothing about drifting. There's nothing about fog line. There's nothing about...
Well, the drifting was testified to by the other officer, Officer Herr, correct?
Correct. And he filed out a supplemental report, did not include anything about any conduct. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your argument, for your briefing and your oral argument today. Much appreciated. It will help us to arrive at a decision. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.